If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All of the major continents could have stopped it. All of them, including Britain. And the fact that they let the peace of the world slip through their hands is worse than a mistake or an error. It's a tragedy.
That was Jay Winter discussing the outbreak of the First World War.
Through the 17th century, it became much more common to put the Pope on the bonfire, so Pope-burning processions were much more common. Mm. So really an 18th century idea that Guido Fawkes might personify.
And that was Claire Jackson talking about the gunpowder plot. You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available from all good newsagents or via subscription. Check out our latest subscription deals at historyextra.com/subscribe. The magazine is also now available on many digital devices, including the iPad, iPhone, Kindle, Kindle Fire, Google Play, Kobo and Zinio. Look out for us in your app store or newsstand, or find out more at historyextra.com/digital. Hello, and welcome to this week's podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. Our first interview this week is with Jay Winter, a professor of history at Yale University, and one of the world's leading authorities on the First World War and its legacy. He edited the multi-volume Cambridge History of the First World War, which was published earlier this year to critical acclaim. A few weeks ago, he paid a visit to the UK, and we sent our web editor, Emma McFarnan, to meet him and share his thoughts on the conflict as it reached its centenary.
We understand you've edited the new Cambridge History of the First World War. Sounds fascinating. Would you be able to tell us a little bit more about that?
The Cambridge History of the First World War is 3 volumes, 70 chapters from historians all over the world, and it is truly a global history in that it entails summaries of research, best practice, learning on the First World War in all continents and in all theaters of military operation. So it is an attempt to create what we call a transnational history, a history that traverses the borders of the nations that waged war in 1914 to 18 to show how much of a global earthquake it was.
I understand you sort of, I saw mention about the cost of war. I mean, I was really interested to read that. What conclusions did you reach on that matter?
One of the conclusions that's come out of a systematic study of the global accounting of war is that we have consistently underestimated the number of people who died, and we've consistently have underestimated certain categories of illness, most egregiously that of psychological disability, what we call shell shock. By looking at different national experiences and bringing them together, it's possible to say that the official estimates of 2 to 4% of all those who were injured in one way or another, 2 to 4% of all casualties suffered by soldiers of the First World War were psychological, is a vast underestimate, perhaps on the order of a factor of 10. So my guess is somewhere between 20 and 40% of all men who were injured in one way or the other had psychological disability as well as their physical disabilities. And this conclusion arises from the projection backward of the medical history of the Second World War. If you look at Monte Cassino, it's a terrible war, but it certainly didn't leave anything to the imagination of those who had been through the Battle of the Somme, or Passchendaele, or Verdun, or the Italian front, or Gallipoli. So the claim that I think we can make is that for a whole series of reasons, we have underestimated the army of the psychologically disabled who lived through the interwar years without acknowledgement, without pension, without help, and without much hope.
And that brings me on to my next question about the sort of medical care, the transformation, if that's the right word, of medical care at that time.
Well, again, the medicine is transnational. It's not something that happens in one country. People read the findings of medical journals in different countries, and there are all kinds of mixed outcomes. The first, for example, is when you next go to the dentist, think about the First World War, because Novocaine is one of the products, painkiller. There are all kinds of forms of surgery that develop because of the necessity of finding ways of putting bones together and so on. So there were medical advances, there's no question about it. But the medical profession is by and large conservative, and it adopts a habit of trying to keep within the boundaries of known practice the recommendations that it gives. And in this respect, the development of treatment for shell shock was extremely slow. And the majority of practitioners, medical practitioners, didn't believe there was a category called shell shock. So it took a long time before the likelihood of an individual who suffered a wound also having a psychological injury. You can imagine if someone doesn't have his legs or half a face or other forms of disability, that the consequences of that are not only physical. It took a long time for that to arrive as a norm of treatment and practice in the medical profession.
And in terms of looking at the wider picture, how did the war change the world, if you can summarize that?
Well, the first thing that the First World War did in leaving its mark on the century that followed is to destroy the notion of progress as an inevitable feature of human development. If you look at the great world's fairs of 1900, let's say, or the ones earlier, 1889 or 1851, they're all about the onward march of humanity, which usually means white humanity, but nonetheless, the onward march of humanity. The First World War showed, as Paul Valéry put it, that we are mortal, that the Western society, if you want to call it that, European society, was capable of committing suicide. This had great consequences in multiple directions. One of them is to give heart to those who both created and defended the Bolshevik Revolution, that they had a future, whereas the decadent bourgeois West that had engaged in this bloodbath had none. It was an old, outmoded civilization. In South America, for instance, the idea of looking to Europe as the model of social development was blown to pieces. And instead, a composer like Brazilian Villa-Lobos, who previously had written music a la Debussy, you know, in a French manner, decided to do Brazilian music, to turn inward. To an extent, Latin America became independent of Europe culturally as a result of the First World War. Of course, the United States came in and filled the imperial gap pretty rapidly, but nonetheless, the notion that the world of 1914 could be recreated after 1918 was blown apart. And I think the most important issue is that the First World War was both the apogee and the beginning of the end of empire. It was an imperial war won through the imperial power of Britain and France, which is precisely what Germany didn't have. Germany fought the war to gain an empire, but needed an empire to win the war. So it was impossible, virtually from the beginning of the war, for Germany to win. On the other hand, multiple movements all over the world took Woodrow Wilson's idea of self-determination that came as a justification of American entry into the war, a kind of war aim, took it seriously without realizing that he meant self-determination for white people. So the Chinese wanted their land back, and the Japanese had occupied part of China, Shandong province, birthplace of Confucius, wanted it back as Chinese after the war. They didn't get it because Japan had claims through its naval power that China didn't have. The result of this was the creation of a student movement called the Fourth of May Movement that produced the Chinese Communist Party. The Chinese Communist Party is a direct outcome of the First World War. If you want to see the hostility between Japan and China, which exists today in historical perspective, you've got to go back to the war. So the balance of geopolitical power was radically altered. The beginnings of the end of empire accompanied its high point. It's one of those great contradictions that the structure of power in the world radically altered, but it took a century for that alteration to work through its consequences.
How has remembrance changed of the First World War?
I think fundamentally there are three different schools of remembrance of the First World War. The British and Anglo-Saxon school is one which has the First World War as, I would say, a catastrophe. The way that Ted Hughes used to describe it is a defeat around whose neck someone hung a victory medal. So there's a dark, luminous glow attached to this event. And then there are those who don't use the word commemoration, use the word celebration. And I think there you have, partly it's true of the French, because they threw several million uninvited German guests off their territory. In Belgium, the same thing. In Poland, for instance, the independence of Poland is a result of the breakdown of the imperial system of Germany, Russia, and Austria-Hungary that had basically split Poland for 150 years. But the critical thing to bear in mind is that the notion of celebration in certain parts of the world about the First World War is incompatible with the notion of commemoration, which is an act of mourning. So you have those two. And there's a third dimension of the First World War, which sees it as a stage on the way to something else. For example, national independence, decolonization, or communism. And there the war is, as it were, an antechamber of history. I've been to Japan, China, Singapore, and there the First World War is only now beginning to open up as a subject of fundamental importance. So the Anglo-Saxon way of doing it, which I think, by the way, is different from the Americans, who basically don't consider it as a serious matter because they were only in the war for 18 months. The Second World War, again, is a screen memory, including the First World War. The Anglo-Saxon world, bar the Americans, sees the First World War through a glass darkly. Many Europeans, not all, but many Europeans see it as a matter of independence, in the French and the Polish case, for instance. The Serbian case is one of those, too. So there's something to celebrate. There are people who celebrate the assassination of Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo. It's hard to believe, you know, that, that terrorism, about which we know something today, should be celebrated, but it's there. And then there's the third group of people who see the First World War as an antechamber to their history.
And you mentioned mourning there. Do you think that our emotional perspective, and especially at the moment, it's very emotionally charged, it seems. Does that cloud our judgment and analysis of the First World War?
No, I think the First World War is highly emotive for the simplest reason that it was the biggest bloodbath in history, and that families all over the world measure the First World War. Well, they measure themselves by the absences, by who isn't there. And who isn't there is everywhere. I spent a reasonable amount of time now in Australia, and the First World War was captured brilliantly by the great historian of Australia at war, Bill Gammage, wrote a book called The Broken Years. Now, their heroism is celebrated in Australia. Their determination to win against all the odds, even when defeat faced them in Gallipoli, that they honor. But there's something that was broken in the First World War, which is, I think, explained by ordinary people in terms of their family history. Because the First World War was the moment when family history and world history crossed, then the affect of mourning becomes attached to the First World War itself.
Again, moving on to kind of how we remember the war today, do you think there's been a lot of discussion for us about Blackadder and whether it did more harm than good in terms of how we think of the First World War? Do you have any strong views either way on that?
The critical point was made 50 years ago. When BBC Two launched its Channel 2 with the 26-hour series on the Great War, still the finest television history ever put together, the people who wrote it were conservative historians, Corelli Barnett, John Terrain, and they wrote it in a certain script that the war was won, it was hard, it was awful, it was bloody, it was terrible, but it was won. But the public saw the images, not the words, and what they saw was the horror of the war. And I think there's what I would call a pacifist shadow of the First World War, which exists to this day in the Anglo-Saxon world. I taught for 25 years at Cambridge, and every year I would get people saying, "Great Uncle Harry," or "Grandfather," or so on. These kinds of family associations are real. But at the same time, the notion that war is not a legitimate choice for governments has come out as a result of a whole series of mistakes that were made, the first of which was the First World War. It was a catastrophic moment. And that's why I think the notion that Blackadder did harm or a disservice or something is silly, because it's not necessarily the history that matters, but the family history that matters. And families see the First World War as an extravagant and catastrophic waste of human life. And indeed, if I'm right, that the psychological casualties of soldiers who fought the First World War have been unrecognized. The war cast a shadow over family life for 50 years after. That's why the novels of Pat Barker are so powerful. You know, she was the illegitimate daughter of a shell-shocked man of the First World War, and then he vanished from their family life, and another shell-shocked man came into it who became her effective father. This is the story of millions of families. And it's never been recognized because it's not in the National Archives. It's in the family archives. And they're the ones that last. So Blackadder catches something that crosses the lines of family misery, family sadness, looking after a psychologically disabled man without public acknowledgement, without a pension, without medical care, without hope. This is the burden that war put on the shoulders, by and large, of women, and it's never been acknowledged to this day. So how can Blackadder do more damage than what the war did to the millions of men who suffered through it?
And given, you know, we've talked about mourning, the loss of life, do you think, after all your research, was it right to go to war in 1914?
The decision to go to war in 1914 was taken by every government on the basis that it was acting in a defensive war, that it didn't bring war about, but that it had been forced into the conflict. Every country took that view. Now we know that, by and large, that wasn't true. All of the major combatants could have stopped it, all of them, including Britain. And the fact that they let the peace of the world slip through their hands is worse than a mistake or an error. It's a tragedy. I wouldn't call it a crime because the notion of pointing fingers, as in Article 231 of the Paris Peace Conference, said Germany is guilty. So, yes, there are different levels of responsibility for the war. But I think the notion of tragedy is captured brilliantly by Christopher Clark's Sleepwalkers, in which he basically says they knew the destructive potential of the weapons that they had, the arms that they had, but they didn't really understand what they were doing. They were sleepwalkers in the sense of walking through the world without an understanding and a consciousness of the violence they were about to inflict on millions of people. So was it a mistake? Yes, I think it was a mistake, by and large, repeated over 4 years, in which the basic decencies of millions of men who went to war were betrayed by their leaders, military and political, who simply didn't understand what they were doing.
You mentioned their responsibility, different levels of responsibility. Do you think it's possible to say who was the most responsible for the outbreak of war?
I think now the older view, which I've shared for a long time, that the war was hatched as an idea in Berlin and in Vienna, Germany and Austria-Hungary, and then became irresistible to the other great powers, has to be changed. Each of the major powers had it within her reach, and immediate reach, to stop it. And we know now, because the end of the Soviet Union has opened up the Russian archives, we know the role played by certain Russian figures that we didn't before. We know the role of Serbian military intelligence in dealing with the Black Hand and other student radicals. So my sense is that every single combatant country had a responsibility for not stopping the war. But Germany and Austria-Hungary had the responsibility for lighting the match that set it off.
Going back to commemoration and how we're looking at the First World War and remembering it today, what do you think of how it's been done so far in the US, coming here to Britain?
Well, one of the things, I've traveled around the world, in the course of this last year, to my utter amazement, it's an avalanche. I've had 52 different commitments, of public speaking commitments, wow, on commemoration. Basically, I can tell you one thing that is quite extraordinary for me as an historian. By and large, commemoration is bottom-up. It happens from local authorities, not from the state. The state follows public opinion, and public opinion is family opinion. And so I think this is one of the great populist moments. The critical point about this is that it's not directed by the government. It comes from local institutions, therefore is in many ways very impressive as a product of civil society, not the state. The second thing that is fascinating for me, and I see this in France, where I'll have my retirement from next year on in Paris, is that historians don't matter at all. The stories that people bring with them to the First World War, the Blackadder stories, they generate without us. We simply are swimming in a stream that we didn't create and don't control. So historians are, I would argue, a bit like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern and Hamlet. We're on the margins, but we're not Hamlet, and we certainly don't tell people who Hamlet was. The third thing that I find quite extraordinary is that it's by and large secular. It's very, very, very little of it is religious. Mm. And there was an awful lot of religious statement and opinion. I think, for example, of the War Requiem of Benjamin Britten for the consecration of Coventry Cathedral after the Second World War is a Requiem Mass set to the poetry of Wilfred Owen. It's 1962. Since then, 50 years have passed, and by and large, religious practice has gone into disuse, so that the terms in which people frame commemoration are not sacred, they're secular. They're about the loss of life and the loss of limb and the loss of hopes, loss of belief in the possibility of mastering the world. It's as if, the First World War was a bloodbath inducing a kind of lesson in humility. So I think the landscape of commemoration that I've seen has shown that in many parts of the world, war is not a matter to celebrate. It's a matter to mourn and to grieve over. And that grief is, by and large, something that happens. I think this is important. To me, the museums, like the Imperial War Museum and the others, cemeteries, battlefield sites that I spend a lot of time in, since I still help run a museum of the First World War in France. These sites of memory are the cathedrals of the 21st century. That's where great moral problems are posed. Maybe not answered fully, but at least posed. Once I went to a meeting at the Imperial War Museum not long ago, maybe 6 months ago, and I passed the Anglican church on the other side of the street. There were a handful of people in it. There were thousands in the Imperial War Museum. So, remembrance happens in place, in sight. And because the costs of travel are so low now compared to what they were 50 years ago or a century, people from all over the world are pilgrims of memory. And, you know, the best instance of that is next March, April, Gallipoli is full. There's no vacancies. The Australians had to have a lottery in order to see which of the, I don't know, 8,000, 10,000 people are going to go, because the sheer volume of pilgrimage threatens to ruin the sites themselves. It's as if remembrance is a danger to the site of memory being remembered, being as we're venerated. And this is happening everywhere. The traffic in war tourism has never been bigger. And has never been younger. It's not just students and pupils at schools, but young people all over the world are traveling to these sites of extraordinary importance for their family history.
And just one sort of final thing is, we haven't talked much about the American involvement and how it's being remembered in the US. I mean, what is it like from the American point of view now?
Well, 1914 is a non-event in the United States, and there will be something in 1970. There is a national First World War Museum in Kansas City, Missouri, and it's doing very well. It's extremely well attended. But the position, I think, of the majority of the American population is still dominated by the Second World War and the Cold War. What makes it perhaps more complex is the vast population that is the result of both documented and undocumented migration. There are people from all over the world, Chinese, Japanese, Europeans, Asians, Vietnamese. There are so many instances where immigrants can have their own family stories, but I think the American story is not at all unified. It's as most things, there's everything in the United States, the good, the bad, and the indifferent. And there are those who are deeply committed to the commemoration of the First World War, those who haven't heard about it, and a whole range of people in the middle.
And just one final question to end on. It's a bit of a broad question, but I'm just wondering how, over the course of your career, how has your perception of the First World War changed? Can you recall your initial perceptions back when when you first realised this is what you had a passion to study? How's it changed?
The first thing is, I took an undergraduate seminar in 1965 at Columbia University with a great historian, Fritz Stern, thank God, still alive. 1965, and I'm still in that seminar.
Wow.
Great teachers do that. Where I started was with the view that the First World War was Europe's Vietnam, that it was a meaningless, stupid, bloody, cruel, harsh, appalling conflict, that the United States was about to indulge in 1965 to 1975. When I started, the subject was very small, and none of us really knows the structure of our lives while we're living them. But I had no idea I'd be a First World War historian forever. And the subject expanded exponentially. But in the course of it, what happened, I think the Vietnam effect is important. There were a number of very important interventions in our understanding of the First World War that came from cultural historians, came from literary historians. And I'm here for a meeting on war poetry. And the cultural turn that succeeded the collapse of Marxism as a theory of history has attached itself to the First World War in particular because of the effect on language. The war poets are just one instance of it, where language itself was cleaned up from the ugly deformations of propaganda. That's what war poets do. They clean up language to make it real and maybe human again. That's what Owen and Sassoon did. And as a result of the shift in historical study away from a certain kind of materialist interpretation to ideas and cultures, the First World War grew radically. So from the mid-1980s, I've been a cultural historian of the First World War, and it's dominant in the Cambridge history to which you referred at the beginning of our conversation. There are three volumes, one called Global War, which really is that, a second on the state, because the state ran the war, and transnational histories are histories about states acting across borders, clearly. And the third volume is called Civil Society, which is about cultural history. And cultural history is simply the study of how people in the past have made sense of the world in which they lived. And this volume is how people in the past, during the First World War and after, made sense of the violent world in which they lived. So that's been the sort of the focus of my research over the last 20 years. And, you know, to reach retirement age with the privilege and enormous effort of putting out the three volumes, 2,600 pages, of the Cambridge History of the First World War with 70 different authors in it, has been an experience that I will bring with me into retirement.
That was Professor Jay Winter. The Cambridge History of the First World War is available to purchase now, published by Cambridge University Press.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/History Extra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/History Extra.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
And now let's return to Emma for the latest history news.
The Natural History Museum plotted to kill the Loch Ness Monster and display its carcass, according to newly published papers. Featured in David Clark's latest book, Britain's Extraordinary Files, The documents show that in March 1934, an unnamed official at the museum issued instructions to bounty hunters on how to tackle the mythical creature. The official said, "Should you ever come within range of the monster, I hope you will not be deterred by humanitarian considerations from shooting him on the spot and sending the carcass to us in cold storage, carriage forward. Short of this, a flipper, a jaw or a tooth would be most welcome." To read about some of the other revelations and historic mysteries featured in Clark's new book, visit historyextra.com. In other news, a new study suggests that some of London's most popular picnic sites could be situated on top of plague pits. Victims of the 17th century outbreak of bubonic plague were laid to rest in emergency burial sites, hundreds of pits scattered across the city and surrounding countryside. Now, The Telegraph reports, Historic UK has released a map of the plague pit based on a variety of sources, including Peter Ackroyd's London, The Biography, Daniel Defoe's A Journal of the Plague Year, and Basil Holmes's The London Burial Grounds, Notes on Their History from the Earliest Times to the Present Day. According to the map, there were plague pits in Golden Square, Soho, Green Park, Shepherd's Bush Green, Christ Church Gardens, Westminster, and the site of Sainsbury's in Whitechapel. The outbreak of bubonic plague between 1665 and 1666 is thought to have wiped out 15% of London's population. Meanwhile, an air raid shelter built for Benito Mussolini and the Italian dictator's family during the Second World War has opened to the public for the first time. Originally a villa's wine cellar, the shelter in Rome was quickly constructed in 1940 by encasing the underground kitchen area in reinforced concrete. It features double steel doors and a contraption to purify air in case of a gas attack. It is not known if the dictator ever used the bunker. Tours of the shelter will run on weekends starting from the end of October, the National Post reports.
Thanks, Emma. As regular listeners will know, we're always keen to receive your feedback about this podcast, which you can send in via podcast@historyextra.com, as well as on social media. One listener who got in touch recently was Julia Wood from Washington, D.C. Julia writes, "I've discovered your podcast and I love it so far. My favourite episode has been The History of Humanity. Not only was the subject matter interesting, but Yuval Harari made it entertaining and pleasant to listen to. I'm definitely interested in listening to interviews and lectures that he gives, as well as reading some of his work. Keep up the good work." Thanks for your feedback, Julia. And if you've missed the episode she's referring to, it's still available for download from our website and other providers. It was broadcast on the 25th of September this year. Next week, many people in Britain will be celebrating Bonfire Night, which marks the anniversary of the failed 1605 plot to blow up the Houses of Parliament. Our features editor, Charlotte Hodgman, paid a visit to Coton Court in Warwickshire, home to one of the plot's perpetrators, in the company of historian Dr. Claire Jackson, to find out more about the dramatic events of 400 years ago.
So Claire, we're at Coton Court in Warwickshire. We come here to talk about Guy Fawkes and the gunpowder plot. But before we get into the relevance of this site, perhaps we can just talk about the plot itself and the history behind it. So just got to take us back to the beginning. Where did the idea of this plot come from? What was sort of happening at the time in England to kind of make this happen?
Well, the key moment is probably the change of dynasty from the Tudors to the Stuarts. Elizabeth had been famously excommunicated by the Pope in 1570, and that had loosened all the Catholics from any allegiance to what the Pope called a heretical sovereign. She didn't have any heirs. There was always a lot of uncertainty about the succession, who would be queen or king after her death. Always hopes that the Spanish might get involved or some other foreign power. But then James succeeds in 1603. He's got the strongest claim, but he's also a Protestant and he's got three heirs, two sons and a daughter. Mm-hmm. And that kind of focuses quite a lot of people's minds that actually that air of uncertainty has gone. James, unlike Elizabeth, is also keen on making a peace with Spain. Mm-hmm. He talks a lot about tolerance, but actually doesn't seem inclined to permit legal toleration. So suddenly horizons begin to shrink for quite a lot of Catholics. People, there's a wide spectrum of Catholic opinion. Yeah. Some people are prepared to put up with all sorts of privations or fines or imprisonments. But others actually think, no, this isn't actually going to re-Catholicise England. If we actually want to get rid of this heretical Protestant religion, we need to do something quite decisive. So the actual group of plotters are quite a small group of men in their mid-30s.
Yeah.
Their parents had all suffered hugely, parents' generation, grandparents' generation, under the sort of recusancy laws. Mm. And it seems as though the small group thought, no, actually, we need to do something now.
So their aim was to kind of get Catholicism back as the primary religion in England.
One of the things that historians debate a lot is what were their aims, and there's a lot of reasons why that's not clear, particularly as many of the main conspirators themselves were blown up in the sort of the aftermath of the explosion at Holbeach House, which is quite near where we are at the moment. So a lot of it is reconstructed from some of the plotters' testimonies and other people's evidence at later trials.
Yeah.
But as far as one can see, there was an attempt to take out both James and his family, sort of his heretical Scots king, who was perceived by a lot of the foreigners as being, by the plotters as being a foreigner.
Yeah.
And quite poignantly as well, take out the Houses of Parliament. It wasn't just assassinating a monarch, it was actually that House of Parliament that had passed all these anti-Catholic penal laws as well.
Mm.
There seems to be a lot of emphasis on blow up the king, blow up Parliament, take out all of the, you know, all the sort of political establishment. There'll be so much chaos that we'll be able to reconstruct a Catholic state in the aftermath. Actually, the plotters don't place a lot of emphasis on the change of religion in some of their plotting or some of the evidence that survives. The idea seems to have been to abduct James's daughter, who was staying quite close by here in the Midlands, make her a sort of puppet sovereign. And the rest of the sort of blueprint seems a bit unclear thereafter.
And the people involved, I mean, everyone, you say Gunpowder Plot and everyone talks about Guy Fawkes, but obviously there are other people involved. Who were sort of the key people behind the plot?
There's a small group of conspirators, all in their mid-30s, all from well-established, most of them from well-established Catholic families. Actually, being here at Coton really kind of focuses the mind, because a lot of them have Throckmorton connections, even if that's not really in their name. Yeah. As you say, we think of Guy Fawkes. Perhaps he's maybe the exception. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons that he's recruited to this group of conspirators is partly that he's a clean face, that he's been on the continent for a lot of the 1590s and 1600s, and he's the one who can be trusted to take the gunpowder into London. Perhaps the most sort of magnetic, sort of charismatic centre of the plot is Robert Catesby,
mm-hmm.
And he recruits two brothers, Thomas and Robert Winter. He recruits several other individuals, Francis Tresham. And interestingly, both Tresham and Catesby's mothers were Throckmortons. There's a lot of Midlands intermarriage all around where we are at the moment, of sort of Catholic families. But a very small group of conspirators, all of whom are recruited by Catesby, really, for their particular expertise, whether it's access to the House of Commons or whether it's expertise in ballistics.
Mm. So, I mean, it sounds like it took a lot of planning. How long were they sort of plotting this before it actually took place or was going to take place?
Some of that's quite unclear, because one of the problems with reconstructing how it happened is that there's a tendency, a lot of it comes from Tom Winter's confession in his trial, and there was a lot of temptation for someone like Winter to place a lot of emphasis on those who'd already died and been blown up, so particularly Catesby and Wright and some of the others. Partly to protect some of the people who are still alive, but also sort of priests. There's quite a lot that surviving testimonies leave out.
Yeah.
But certainly this had germs in things like the Essex Rebellion that had started in 1601. There's quite a lot of continuity of personnel between those who'd been involved in Essex's failed plot and those who were later recruited by Catesby.
Mm.
So a mood really over the preceding few years.
Yeah. I mean, how did James's rule compare to that of Elizabeth and Mary in terms of how Catholics were treated? I mean, did they have really cause to be doing this?
Well, Mary's reign was obviously the great moment for Catholics.
Yeah.
Elizabeth's was fluctuated, and the Bull of Excommunication in 1570 actually fractured the sort of Catholic community in some ways, because it made practicing Catholicism almost now a form of sort of treason. It sort of clarified the lines between what might just be quiet, sort of occasional conformity, what we often call church papists, to those who were radically committed. Again, being here in Coton Court, one of the relatives of this house, a Throckmorton, had been involved in a Throckmorton plot in 1583 to restore Mary, Queen of Scots.
Okay.
So there's a sort of history of sporadic plots.
Mm.
A lot of people were quite hopeful that James would be different. His mother had been a Catholic, Mary, Queen of Scots.
Yeah.
She'd been executed by Elizabeth I. There were quite a lot of Catholics who really thought he might try and seek vengeance on her martyrdom. But James is a very committed Protestant. He talks a lot of language about tolerance, and he's clearly not a persecutory king by nature, but he's equally very concerned about the political threat that radical Catholics would pose to his throne.
So what actually happened on the 5th of November? How do things actually play out?
Well, it's more just a couple of days before. It's a betrayal. I mean, the reason we probably know about the plot is to do with the fact that just days before, one of the conspirators, Tresham, who is related again to this family here at Coton, probably sent, it's still not clear if he did or not, probably sent a warning letter to his brother-in-law, the Catholic peer, Lord Monteagle, presumably knowing that he would show it to members of the Privy Council. This was alerted to the King. James is particularly nervous about anything to do with gunpowder. His father's been blown up by gunpowder himself. He takes it seriously, whereas quite a few other people don't. There's various searches of the Houses of Commons. Those are the sort of images that we know quite powerfully of Guy Fawkes being found with all of this gunpowder sort of just underneath the Commons chamber. He's arrested, taken into custody, amazingly resolute under questioning, doesn't reveal very much, or actually doesn't really know perhaps what's panning out. But then it begins to circle around where we are at the moment in the Midlands. Seems to have been the assumption that there would be a great explosion, complete mayhem. Princess Elizabeth could be seized. There'd be a big sort of Catholic rising around the Midlands, instead of which you begin to get quite a very quick fall away. The sort of the nucleus of the conspirators try to sort of prolong it a little bit, try to sort of see through their objectives. They plunder Warwick Castle and various others. But it begins to fracture Catholics in terms of those who are terrified by what they hear. And eventually it ends out in a sort of shootout at Holbeach House, not far from here.
And what about the logistics of getting the gunpowder into Parliament, actually getting access to that amount of gunpowder as well? How did that
Well, again, that was sort of a lot to do with Catesby's skillful recruitment, that he involved Thomas Percy, who's a servant of the Earl of Northumberland, who has access to lodgings directly under the Commons Chamber. Okay. This takes months overnight. During nighttime, they row across the Thames. I mean, it takes a long time to assemble that amount of gunpowder. But again, it's just a few trusted individuals.
So they did quite well, really, to not be discovered up until that point.
And certainly James takes it absolutely seriously and, you know, said, make no mistake. I mean, had this happened, this would have been the biggest conflagration. I mean, it wasn't only the explosion itself, it's all the kind of noxious fumes. You know, certainly so many, all of the political establishment would have been taken out.
Yeah. And so what happened to those who were caught?
Someone like Guy Fawkes initially passes himself off under a different name. James interrogates him himself and says, I can't find anybody who knows this person. And that was part of his attraction, that he was a clean face, who'd been on the continent, he'd got a lot of ballistics technical experience and knowledge. He was the right person there. Even James kind of admires his, what he calls sort of Roman resolution under torture, that he doesn't sort of crack. But eventually, the net sort of closes in on various individuals. There's a shootout at sort of Holbeach House when the main conspirators die. But others, like Father Henry Garnet, that had been here, are later arrested, put on trial for treason. So those that were captured were mostly executed.
So when do the people who at Coton Court, when do they find out what's happened down in London?
So the morning after, Catesby's servant, Thomas Bates, arrives with a letter from Catesby, and he finds both Father Garnet here and Lady Digby, Everard Digby, who was one of the conspirators as well, who had rented this property in October from the Throckmortons. They read the letter and immediately they sort of are appalled. They would have blown up Parliament House and were discovered. We were all utterly undone. And there's sort of they're really distraught. I think Lady Digby realises her husband's now placed himself sort of beyond any hope of sort of redemption. And Garnet claims that, he tried to dissuade radical conspirators from this sort of type of action.
But they didn't believe him.
They always have problems with Garnet. He's a sort of classic equivocator.
I mean, we're actually sitting, supposedly in the room where two women were sitting, weren't they, when they found out what had happened. And there's also... There's a priest hole just to our right here. The priest holes, I mean, were they typical of these types of houses, Catholic homes? Mm. Did they have...
Yeah, this is a really atmospheric room, partly because it's so light, it's at least sort of triple aspected, and you can see for miles all around the sort of Forest of Arden. So that, in a way, makes it terrific for checking if any sort of unwelcome presence is approaching. And this is apparently where Garnet said Mass on All Souls Day, which was only sort of 4 days before the gunpowder plot. And yes, I mean, most Catholic recusant houses had at least one priest hole. That's quite a famous sort of double priest hole above a staircase. In a way, the response to it is quite measured. You might have expected that if a monarch like James was looking for an excuse to go completely after Catholics, this would be the perfect example. But James realises that this is the work of a hardened minority and that actually most Catholics are fairly loyal and peace-loving. I mean, ironically, it's the families that are involved in the plot that later become key royalists in the civil wars a generation later. So he simply presses ahead with oaths of allegiance, really trying to separate out those Catholics who will not swear an oath of temporal loyalty to him as their sovereign from those Catholics who absolutely refuse that.
And there were executions of the perpetrators, were there? Were they public?
They were public, and the timings of them, people like Garnet's execution was moved a couple of days so it couldn't be near Easter in case it began to assume sort of an idea of martyrdom.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, those sorts of public executions are always slightly double-edged for the authorities because you don't want to give somebody a platform, to sort of announce that they're dying an unjust death for their cause.
And why do you think this is the plot that people remember of the 17th century, don't they? Why is that? Is it because of the impact it could have had, or...?
It wasn't immediately always celebrated. I mean, it became part of us by the 18th century, sort of post the Williamite Revolution, it began to be sort of safe almost to sort of celebrate these particular events. Mm. It was a sort of seen as absolutely sort of significant that William of Orange landed at Torbay on the 5th of November, 1688. And suddenly, remember the 5th of November got going really in the 18th century.
Okay.
And the figures of Guy Fawkes began to sort of epitomise it. But in the 17th century, there was a lot of mention of powder treason, but there were quite a lot of other events, like the Irish Rebellion in 1641 or the Popish Plot in 1683, that could be seen as the next stage in this endemic Catholic conspiracy, but there wasn't quite the same tendency to sort of home in completely just on the 5th of November. You know, it's this image that we have of Guy Fawkes and his 36 barrels of gunpowder and all of that. I mean, we put him on the bonfire, but through the 17th century, it had been much more common to put the Pope on the bonfire, so Pope burning processions were much more common. Mm. It's really an 18th century idea that Guido Fawkes might personify. I think that's probably the main point as well, that we have this image in our minds that it's all to do with Westminster and the Thames and the heart of government. But it was only ever really sort of the first strike. It was going to be the sort of prelude to chaos. And this was really this Catholic heartland in the Midlands where they were hoping that all of these plotters were pretty much interrelated and knew each other within this sort of shadowy, quite clandestine world of sort of English Catholicism, that might be the key for a Midlands rebellion.
Yeah, I mean, we were looking at a map, weren't we, earlier, and they're all so close together, all these different sort of Catholic properties.
And that would be a sort of standard route for priests or for Catholics looking for safe houses. I mean, they would be very, very well known to each other. And actually, behind us, there's this sort of painted tapestry of Catholics who've suffered for their faith and in stained glass windows in houses like this. I mean, the real way of perpetuating a family's power if they were deprived of political office or anything because of their Catholicism was really through marriage. So it's really to try and keep your dynasty strong and powerful. Yeah, that was the main way in which a Catholic dynasty could operate.
And just going back to kind of how it was all kind of found out, the letter, why was the letter sent? Why it was warning somebody, wasn't it, a Catholic in Parliament?
Yeah, so there is a letter that's delivered at Sion House to Lord Monteagle, who is Francis Tresham's brother-in-law. It's assumed that Tresham sent the letter, but not entirely clear, warning him not to attend the Commons on that night. And certainly there seems to have been evidence among the plotters themselves that they were concerned about good Catholics being blown up. Now, someone like Catesby thought, there has to be some what we would now call collateral damage, that sort of thing just happens. Catesby sort of famously says, even if it was my own son, there's a greater cause here. But there's obviously nervousness, and particularly among people like Tresham, who repeatedly tried to offer the conspirators money to go abroad to do something different. I mean, he was probably the mistake in the recruitment link by Catesby.
He's sort of the weak link.
That was Dr. Claire Jackson of Trinity Hall, Cambridge, with our own Charlotte Hodgman. Dr. Jackson recently appeared in BBC Two's drama documentary Gunpowder 511, The Greatest Terror Plot, which is still available to view on the BBC iPlayer. And you can also read an article by Charlotte and Claire in the November issue of BBC History magazine, which is on sale now. Also in this month's magazine, you'll find articles on the Peasants' Revolt, Napoleon, the Battle of the Bulge and Agincourt. You can get hold of the magazine in all good newsagents and digitally. And if you're keen to try out the digital edition of BBC History magazine, we have a special offer running this weekend. From Friday to Sunday, all new subscribers to our iPad, iPhone, Kindle Fire and Google Play editions can enjoy a free 30-day trial. If you then decide you don't want to continue with your subscription, then just cancel it within the 30-day period and you won't have to pay anything. Look out for us in the newsstand or the App Store to take advantage of this offer. And that's almost all for this week. Do join us next time when we'll be talking about the fall of the Berlin Wall with Hester Vasey, while Ronald Hutton will be chatting about the restoration of Charles II. Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com. And we might read out your messages in future episodes. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, where you will find history quizzes, galleries, articles, and more. Plus, it's where you can download every single previous episode of this podcast.